Hey, everybody, and welcome to episode 19 of ZU Cast. I'm Amanda Van Hyl. I'm going to be one of your hosts. And then I'm also joined by my dear friend, Cody Davies.
Hello, everybody. My name is Cody. You may know me from ZeldaUniverse.net, your number one website for Zelda news and information. You should visit it. It's a great website if you haven't heard of it.
And you should also watch Zelda News weekly on ZU TV or Zelda Universe TV on our YouTube channel. And I'm not just saying that because I'm the host. Actually, I am.
Look, Zelda Universe TV, that's a great channel. Do you know, I was the one who created that channel and Zelda Universe was taken. And I was like, well, what can I do with that URL? And actually, the person I saw was Shane Dawson TV. And I was like, TV, that sounds like a good thing to add to the end of Zelda Universe to make it work. So you can thank YouTube celebrity Shane Dawson for our YouTube username.
It sounds super professional by having TV at the end. That's when you like, oh, that's their media publication for TV shows. We know they're legit. So we're going to start off with some Zelda history from 2006 to 2010 with Shona, followed by Peace of Heart, ZU-thon, and Community with Connor.
After that, we have Randy with What If Zelda Was a Metroidvania? So, some interesting Metroid discussion there. And then, of course, the credits.
And bloopers! But you know, you and I are just so perfect, we won't have any bloopers.
Oh no.
Of course not.
We do everything in one take, that's what they call us.
One take wonders, Cody and Amanda.
That's what's on my business card.
Mine just says, gamer. Well, that's what it said on TV that time. Actual TV, not Zelda Universe TV. Actual TV, said Amanda Van Hyl, gamer.
That's right. They were walking through E3 and they were like,
that girl looks like Elle Woods as a gamer. Let's go talk to her.
Yeah, that looks like a gamer. Weren't you wearing like a Jigglypuff shirt or something?
I was wearing like a little Jigglypuff tank top. I've got my blonde hair. My nails were like freshly done. Like it was just, let's find the girliest looking girl here because we want to talk about girls that play video games. And there I was.
That's right. And they're probably just like, how's Barbie Horse Adventures or whatever?
I'm surprised it didn't get that sort of thing. Like, do you play any real games? All right. Well, let's get this show started. Take it away, Shona.
Hey Zelda fans, my name is Shona and I'm back with another look at the history of the Zelda franchise. In this segment, I'll take you through the years from 2006 until 2010. 2006 was a massive year for Nintendo with the release of the Wii. It was a funny name for a console, but it was a huge success due to its motion controls. The reason for the delayed release of Twilight Princess, which I mentioned in my previous segment, became clear when it was announced as a launch title for the Wii. The game was originally developed for the GameCube, and so it did also release on the older console, but a few weeks after the Wii. Twilight Princess also happened to be the first Zelda game to release in a similar timeframe worldwide. Previously, some regions had to wait months after other regions for a game to be released. There were a couple of big differences between the GameCube and Wii versions. The first was that the Wii version incorporated motion controls, while the GameCube stuck with buttons. The second was that the entire world was mirrored in the Wii version. This was done to accommodate the motion controls. Link had traditionally been a left-handed character, but the majority of people are right-handed, and Nintendo thought that it would be confusing for players to swing a Wiimote with their right hand and see Link swing the sword with his left on screen. The easiest solution was to flip everything and make Link a righty for the Wii version. Many Zelda fans still debate today over which version of the game is superior, although for most people it seems to be whichever one they played first. Twilight Princess was another big success and became the best-selling Zelda game of all time up until Breath of the Wild. A new Zelda spin-off game came out in 2006. Tingle was a character who first appeared in Majora's Mask and continued to appear in almost every Zelda game for the next decade. He was popular in Japan, but most Western fans either disliked or outright hated him. Well, this new spin-off Zelda game was all about Tingle. Tingle's freshly picked Rosy Rupee Land for the Nintendo DS first released in Japan and then in Europe the following year, but it was never released in the US. Luckily for American Tingle fans, or those who were morbidly curious at least, the DS wasn't region locked, so they just needed to import the game from Europe. Another Tingle game, Tingle's Balloon Fight DS, was released through Club Nintendo in Japan in 2007. It's basically a Tingle-themed version of the NES classic Balloon Fight. In 2007, a direct sequel to The Wind Waker was released on DS. Phantom Hourglass combined 3D graphics with a mostly overhead perspective, making it more of a 2.5D game. Nintendo clearly wanted to make the most of the DS's hardware, including its touchscreen, and Link and his items were actually controlled via the touchscreen. The touch controls weren't as controversial as, say, motion controls, but they weren't everyone's cup of tea. The game utilised pretty much every hardware gimmick of the DS, from its microphone to even closing the console to solve one puzzle. Phantom Hourglass improved upon the tedious sailing from the Wind Waker, putting the ship on autopilot and giving players challenges and obstacles to overcome while they sailed. But the game added another tedious feature, the Temple of the Ocean King. This dungeon had to be repeated multiple times, had a time limit, and had enemies inside that were almost invincible, requiring stealth and puzzle solving to get through. Overall, Phantom Hourglass's story and many of its characters were mostly forgettable, but Captain Linebeck was a standout. He fulfills the role of comic relief and plot device, but his character really grows as the story progresses. In my opinion, he's one of the most underrated Zelda characters of all. Nintendo released the Wii Zapper, a new piece of hardware for the Wii, in 2007. It was packaged with a Zelda-themed shooting game called Link's Crossbow Training, which was set in the world of Twilight Princess, and features several modes in which Link must demonstrate his marksmanship. 2008 was another quiet year in terms of Zelda game releases, but it saw the next Super Smash Bros. Game, Brawl, for the Wii. It featured the same playable Zelda characters as Melee, with the exception of Young Link, who was swapped out for Toon Link. Additionally, 2008 was the first time that the Akira Himekawa manga was officially released in English, starting with Ocarina of Time. Their manga is still being released to this day. Finally, a different type of book was also released this year, The Legend of Zelda and Philosophy. It contained several essays on how philosophical concepts related to the world of Zelda and video games more broadly. It functioned in gaming circles as a proof of concept that video games could have serious themes and weren't just a silly pastime for kids. After all, people study other forms of entertainment such as music, film, and literature, so why not video games? Let's return to the world of The Wind Waker and Phantom Hourglass. Phantom Hourglass was a direct sequel to The Wind Waker, and in 2009, a sequel to Phantom Hourglass came out on the Nintendo DS, although this one was set 100 years into the future. Spirit Tracks is set in the land of New Hyrule, which was settled by people from the flooded lands we saw in the earlier games. Where the previous two games utilise sailing as the main mode of transport, Spirit Tracks uses trains. When the news that the upcoming Zelda game would be about trains first broke, this caused a fair amount of controversy in the community because a lot of people felt that trains really didn't fit with the Zelda vibe. But by the time the game came out, most people were used to the idea of the train, and it didn't function all that differently to the boat in Spirit Tracks. In fact, the biggest criticism of the train ended up being that it took players away from being able to explore the overworld, because exploration has traditionally been a huge part of many Zelda games. Many previous Zelda games had also featured companions for Link, such as Midna in Twilight Princess or Tattle in Majora's Mask, but in Spirit Tracks, Princess Zelda herself would be Link's companion, or her spirit at least. I've mentioned in previous segments that the late 90s and early 2000s saw the birth of the online Zelda community, with websites, message boards and chat rooms being common places for Zelda fans to hang out. The rise of video sharing websites during the second half of the 2000s led to a surge in video content. Website IGN created a fake Zelda movie trailer and released it as an April Fool's prank in 2008. A web series called The Legend of Neil ran from 2008 until 2010 and was a parody of the series, especially the original game, with a rather adult sense of humour. And the first feature-length fan film premiered in 2009, The Hero of Time. The film was in development for a few years and created a lot of hype in the community, with some people mistakenly believing that it was an official Zelda movie. In fact, for that reason, it was taken offline just a few weeks after release because Nintendo stepped in with a cease and desist. They stated that they needed to protect their property from being confused with fan interpretations of the franchise. This was possibly the first big Nintendo fan project to be shut down by Nintendo, but to Nintendo's credit, they gave the filmmakers permission to keep it online until the end of the year, so that fans who had been looking forward to the movie would at least get to see it. Another Tingle game came out in 2009, but it was only ever released in Japan. Ripe and Tingle's Balloon Trip of Love features Tingle chasing games in a world that's partly inspired by The Wizard of Oz. This was the last Tingle game to be released, at least at the time of recording this. During E3 in 2009, a new Zelda game was announced, but very little information was provided. Instead of a trailer, all we got was a single piece of artwork, which featured Link standing back to back with a mysterious girl who had a lot of features that were similar to the Master Sword. Link is holding his shield, but his other hand was suspiciously empty. This one image caused tons of speculation within the community. More information about the game, Skyward Sword, was revealed at E3 the following year. But apart from the Skyward Sword info, the year 2010 was a pretty quiet one. Where the 2000s saw new Zelda games almost every single year, the 2010s would be a bit different. But you'll have to wait until my next segment to hear more about that. Thank you for joining me on this brief journey throughout the second half of the 2000s, and please feel free to share your own memories from this time in the comments. I'm Shona Johnson, and I hope to see you next time as we surge forwards into the 2010s.
So the 2006 to 2010 era, so that was like Twilight Princess and Phantom Hourglass and Spirit Tracks. Did you play any of that when you were new? When you were new.
Look, when I was born, I loved to play Twilight Princess. Because as we know, it's a game for babies. It's perfect for babies. Because if you want someone to shake a controller, that is one of the few things that babies can do, actually. There's not much you can get in terms of giving a baby a controller. Mostly it would chew on it, like a girl gamer. But sometimes...
Girl gamers lick controllers, thank you, not chew on them.
Okay, sorry. Babies chew on controllers. Girl gamers lick them. I got it mixed up. So anyway, when I was a baby, I loved to play Twilight Princess. When I was 0 years old in the year 2006, because I'm only 14. How old are people?
I was going to say, does that put you like 14? Because I think that's when my nephew was born. It was 2006 or 2007. I don't remember which.
Yeah, so, well, the people who were born when Twilight Princess came out, they're now 14. They're now playing Breath of the Wild, so.
Good for them. I was 20 when Twilight Princess came out, and I had mono, and yeah. I wrote a whole essay about my dislike of Ilya. The mono intensified it.
So nothing's changed.
Well, I guess I don't have mono anymore, but other than that.
Well, you don't have mono anymore, but you're still writing essays about...
Still writing about how much I hate Ilya, you know.
Yeah, Ilya, you can't trust her. She's probably going around licking controllers and things.
And stealing horses. She plays Barbie Horse Adventures. That would be the only game she would play is Barbie Horse Adventure.
I can guarantee that she plays Barbie Horse Adventures. I've never been more sure about something about a Zelda character. Ilya would definitely play Barbie Horse Adventures.
Yeah. Well, that's enough Ilya bashing. I mean, it's really not enough Ilya bashing. I could do that all day. But we're going to go into something a little nicer with some peace of heart with Connor.
10,700 $30.69. That's how much money was raised by the Zelda Universe team during ZUthon last month, our annual charity livestream. This year, benefiting Direct Relief and their efforts to combat the effects of the COVID-19 pandemic. For 100 hours straight, our team of intrepid Zelda adventurers faced the perils of Hyrule and beyond, hoping to help provide the means we need to face the perils we face in our own world. We asked for your support, and you delivered, in a way that was above and beyond anything we'd dare hope to imagine. Attached to that support, and attached to this event as a whole, is a message of strength, of community, and of friendship. The kind of message that you only seem to hear in fantasy tales or anime, and the kind of message that, in a world that has forced us all apart, is nevertheless more relevant and more meaningful than ever before. My name is Connor Schultz, and this is Peace of Heart. The fact of the matter is that The Legend of Zelda is not a multiplayer series. The games focus on Link, the lone hero who must stand against the forces of darkness, armed with little more than a sword, his courage, and whatever he's able to pick up along the way. He may have aid, romantic interests, even a companion or two, but ultimately the fate of Hyrule rests solely on Link's shoulders. And by association, that means only the single player holding the controller truly takes part in the adventure. Sure, Zelda has had its forays into the multiplayer genre with Four Swords and Triforce Heroes, but the hardware requirements for both Four Swords games were taxing, to say the least, and the frustrations people have had with Triforce Heroes haven't exactly been minor. Don't get me wrong, I love these games as much as I love the rest of the series, but when it comes to how the Zelda franchise has progressed as a whole, a team adventure isn't exactly the direction it has gone in. Say what you will, The Legend of Zelda is essentially a one-player game. I grew up with that, and part of the reason I grew so close to the series was because it was something I could play on my own. And I kept playing on my own. That is, until I started to share it. As a personal passion project, I wanted to make videos for YouTube. Video essays expressing my thoughts and perspective and love for the Zelda series. To make those essays, I needed footage. To get that footage, I needed to play the games again. To make the games more fun to share, I eventually invited others to join me. At the same time, I joined Zelda Universe as a features writer, and slowly became introduced to an entire team that loved this series as much as I did. The more I've looked, the more I've seen and met people who express their passion in art, music, even just exclamations of emotion over a scene or a fight. All of it resonating with me. I knew in my head that these fans existed, but for someone who had kept the series close to his chest for over 20 years, discovering such a vibrant community who shared my love for Zelda was like walking out of the Shrine of Resurrection and seeing the massive land of Hyrule before me. Which brings us back to the pandemic and ZUthon. I moved across the country mere months before the world shut down. Like everyone else, the past year and a half has been tense, frustrating, and panic-inducing, enhanced by the fact that the friends I had all lived hundreds of miles away. Even now, I'm sitting in a small apartment with just a dog, my job, and whatever contacts my internet allows me to have. I've held close to those contacts, grateful for the social connections they give me and the way it lets me peek into the passion people have for Zelda. My Twitter feed is full of it, And it brings a smile to my face every time I read of someone enjoying Skyward Sword for the first time, showing art they've made of the princess and the hero, or maybe just revisiting an old favorite from the series. When the ZU team got back together to plan this year's event, I leapt at the chance to be a part of it. And for the 4 days I was there, I enjoyed watching, commenting, and for a few hours playing myself, interacting with these wonderful people I had the privilege of meeting, and with those who came to support our efforts. And while I'm sure that $10,730.69 will help immensely in aiding those most affected by this pandemic, what has helped me the most is the time spent talking and playing with all of you, the wonderful Zelda community. I work for a nonprofit. The entirety of our funding comes from contracts from local government and from donations by others. I've participated in a fair share of fundraisers, and while I can't necessarily compare numbers, I can certainly say that what we all pulled off is nothing short of incredible. But what we've created is a community of people that is willing to bring joy to each other. Beyond just monetary donations, we're creating friendships and support that can help you weather any storm and make heroes out of all of us. From across the globe you play, you talk, and you create, telling and retelling the legend. While each adventure is made alone, those brave souls who face down the King of Evil know where to find support, where they can share their adventures, and where they can express their love for a series that, although played alone, can show us just how much it means to fight for and fight with others. A place that will always hold a piece of my heart. I'm Connor Schultz, and this has been Piece of Heart. I'll see you all next time.
Cody, you took part in ZU-thon, as did I. Why don't you tell everybody about your experience with it and your hole digging?
Yeah, look, I have a very special role in the marathon each year. You could call it the highlight of the ZU Marathon because it's the part that people ask about. When we say we're doing a new marathon, the Facebook comments we get, is the Cody Zone coming back? That's what they want to know. Because what I do in the Cody Zone is I dig some holes for 6 to 8 hours in Oracle of Seasons or Oracle of Ages. This time around, we went with Oracle of Ages. And it's an interesting digging experience, I think. The Oracle games have the best shovel sounds in the Zelda series, so I make sure to dig some holes over and over, and if people want me to make progress, they can pay for it. And that's how I raised a lot of money this year for charity, is by just saying, well, look, if you pay me $50, I'll go to the next dungeon. We actually got reasonably far in this time because we had a good few $100 of donations, so thanks to everyone for coming along to that. How did your segments go, Amanda?
Ours, I think, went really well. We had a poster board up in the background, so anytime somebody donated, they got like a little piece of Triforce with their name on it put on the background. But I have to say, your segment is probably one of the most important because that's when all of us in North America get to sleep.
Yeah, that is the original purpose of my segment. At the moment, in this post-COVID era, we're going from like 3 or 4 hubs and people are remotely playing from a few different areas, but originally it was just, there were just like 80 people at Amanda's house, just a big fire safety hazard.
Yep.
And, you know, they would just be there for like 100 hours. So I said, well, how about you sleep for like 8 hours and I will take over and I will show people a Zelda experience they've never experienced before.
And let me tell you, there is nothing more dead than our house during the Cody Zone. We are all like, because we're all exhausted by the time it gets to the Cody Zone, because we would have been setting up like the whole 2 days before the marathon even started. It gets like just dead quiet. everybody's passed out. It's wonderful. We can all just finally sleep. It's like, that's where one moment just be like, okay, sleeping, nobody bug me. But really, Zyuthon was just a wonderful time. And we do have such a wonderful community. Like, I've made so many wonderful friends through, I've said wonderful a million times. So you know what? That's okay. I've made some fantastic friends through Zelda Universe. And it is definitely life-changing for the better. So that's enough sappiness. Let's move on to what if Zelda was a Metroidvania with Randy.
Hey, thanks for joining me here today. I'm Randy Meyer, assistant news editor at ZeldaUniverse.net. This is my series, What If Zelda Was? You see, different Zelda games mean different things to everybody, and it's one of the series' core strengths. It's why we have endless debates as to what the best Zelda games are and under which circumstances. So I like to take ideas and stretch them into places the series hasn't been before. I would like to ask you now this question. What if Zelda was a Metroidvania? My first answer to my own question, thanks me, is it already is if you really think about it. Ever since Link to the Past and up through Link Between Worlds, the Zelda franchise has had the exact same style of game as Super Metroid or Symphony of the Night. It's a supposedly open world that's actually blocked off by several power or item required gates. For a generic term, I refer to Metroidvanias as the Pathfinder genre. It's all about poking around the world looking for your next path opened by a key item or ability you acquired at some other point. Now, of course, there are game elements that differentiate your Metroids from your Zeldas and your Castlevanias. I'm not saying they're the same thing, but I think there's a reason why something like the Super Metroid / A Link to the Past hybrid randomizer works as well as it does. The two games are structurally similar. I'll admit, I already think Zelda games are far less open world than they claim to be or that other people claim they are. They feature linear story progression and critical paths to follow, and that's why I think Zelda has more in common with your typical Pathfinders like Hollow Knight. But what if Zelda really did play more like a side-scrolling 2D platformer rather than the top-down one we're used to? If you think about it, Link's Adventure was basically this, and Zelda as we know it today could have been something much more like Super Metroid had that idea taken off. The difference, of course, would be action more akin to Castlevanias like Symphony of the Night and Dawn of Sorrow, melee-focused action platforming challenges with abilities designed to work in that kind of an environment. Now I can hear someone out there saying, but Randy, one of the Zelda series' main attractions is the dungeons. Big thematic chunks of levels that center around certain gimmicks. Castlevania and Metroid games don't have those. And I'd have to disagree to an extent. These kinds of Pathfinder games always have zones that focus on specific styles of level. This could just as easily be translated into dungeons. Norfair is essentially just a lava dungeon, for example. While I generally prefer the it's all on one map of a game like Bloodstained, there are other examples that could be used as more specific analogs to dungeons. The second DS Castlevania title, Portrait of Ruin, had this big main Dracula's castle map like every other Castlevania, but then there were these paintings that served as doorways to separate maps, kind of like Mario 64, and that's really not terribly different than how dungeons translate out of a Zelda game. Think about Ocarina of Time. There's this central map of Hyrule, and it just branches off into separate zones like spokes from the center of a wheel. You need key items to progress into different areas, like a horse to get into Lake Hylia, or a hookshot to get across Gerudo Canyon, and you could kind of use that same thing for this side-scrolling structure. And let's face it, it's not like every item in the Zelda is useful anyway. Most of them are only designed to have one puzzle-specific purpose that are virtually useless beyond that. Just like the grapple beam in Super Metroid, the spinner has zero proper functionality in Twilight Princess. It only exists for you to go, oh wait, there's the thing that clearly states this is where I use the item, so let's do that now. In the case of the grapple beam, sure you can use it on any ceiling, but you only really need it over certain chasms. Similarly, yeah, you can ride the spinner everywhere, and it's fun, but you're only going to really use it to grind those obvious rails to reach places you couldn't otherwise with any other items. The Legend of Zelda series has the same use for these finding new items and powers that those games do, which is really the biggest reason I say they're basically the same as a Pathfinder genre. But this is about how it would look like if it were a Metroidvania, and not like one. I think we would have to put a huge focus on combat and perhaps weapon variety. One of the fun things about Symphony of the Night and its similar sequels is finding that set of weapons and powers that play the way you like them. Whether that's a heavy-hitting two-hander that has a wide arc for hitting enemies all around you, or the quick slices of a one-handed sword that require more precise aiming, especially on those airborne keys. I think we can look at Breath of the Wild for an immediate idea of how this would look in the world of Zelda. Similarly, an item like the Sheikah Slate could double down for sources of movement abilities obtained from abilities like the Soul System in Aria and Dawn of Sorrow. Why can Link suddenly move blocks to open new paths? He beat a boss and gained the Magnesis upgrade for his Slate to move them. Recently, I took the time to play 2016's Axiom Verge, a clear love letter to the Metroid series that also does enough of its own thing not to just be considered some sort of clone. One of the first upgrades you get in that game is a drill cannon for cracking through secret walls or putting a constant hurt on an enemy as it gets up close. In perhaps my favorite Castlevania game, Order of Ecclesia, your entire arsenal is made up of magic abilities. You don't get a sword or a whip, though you do get powers to summon a sword and swing it just like you would a normal weapon. My favorite is this sort of like wolf head where you punch forward and this giant energy wolf head takes a bite out of enemies in front of you. So imagine Link with this sort of arsenal and the fun twists and turns it could be on the series. You know, this doesn't just have to be a 2D game with bombs and arrows. Remember that ball and chain from Twilight Princess? Or what if Link could cast fire spells like Din's Fire while using Nehru's Love as a defensive tool? And okay, I just described Zelda from Smash Brothers, but that gets my point. That's where I'm going with this, is there's so many things in Zelda games that you could do on a 2D plane that would just help it fit better into this kind of a 2D Metroidvania type game. The big difference, I think, in a Zelda-style platformer would involve how key items are often the center focus of boss fights and determining how they pan out. The one thing Castlevania never really got a hold of was requiring specific abilities to fight bosses. Sure, you get a mist form to travel around certain areas in Symphony of the Night, and it can be used defensively if you time it right, but it's not really required for any specific fight. Getting the bow and arrow in this Zeldavania would be required to beat bosses related to the area where you found it, or at least the boss that hides behind a door that required the bow and arrow to get into in the first place. In Zelda, we've seen the puzzle where you shoot down the chains to drop a drawbridge, and that's exactly the kind of thing you could do in a game like this with maybe an arced shot. Zelda is renowned for its creative and immersive boss fights, which are more like puzzles than raw combat, and this is again something I don't think you see a lot of in the 2D Metroidvanias, but you do see it a lot more in 3D Metroidvanias, like Metroid Prime, or one of my favorite games ever, Control. In this 2D side-scrolling Zelda, I'd like to see more of those fights require items, timing, and puzzle solving. Top-down Zelda bosses are maybe less puzzly than the 3D ones, but there's still tricks and things you have to figure out in a way that most 2D Metroidvanias still just kind of have you running in and swinging on a boss. I guess what I'm saying here is that I really like Pathfinder games, and I would love to see Zelda take a crack at being more like a Metroid or a Castlevania in its design rather than just another regular Zelda. It may be because there's a new Metroid just a month away from me recording this, which has me giddy as a groovy Goron. But this could be a fun new way to approach another Zelda game. And that's it for me this time. I hope you've enjoyed listening to me talk about why Zelda kinda already is a Metroidvania and how it can make its own cool twists on the genre. I hope you've had a good time with it and would love to see what you think in the comments. And let me know if there's something you'd like to see the Zelda series turned into. Until next time, I'm your segment host, Randy. You can find me on Twitter at RandyMarGames, and I hope you have a lovely rest of your day.
All right, so did Elias pay somebody to talk about Metroid, and that's why we've got a Metroid segment?
Look, I think it's interesting the similarities and differences between a Zelda game and a Metroid game.
there's even a randomizer that's a Link to the Past and Super Metroid. So, I mean, it kind of does work. And he was making some really good points about how, like, okay, Zelda can kind of work as a Metroidvania because of the whole, like, okay, you can't access this. You can see where this area is, but you can't access it until you go back over here to get this item. And I'd never thought about it that way.
Have you been playing Metroid Dread?
I have been, and I love it so much.
How many Metroid games have you played before?
I've played Fusion, I've played Prime, I've played Super Metroid, and I attempted to play the first Metroid, but that didn't go very well. I have the rest of the Prime trilogy, and I have Samus Returns, I just haven't played them yet. I need to get Zero Mission, and then now I've played Dread, or almost. I'm almost done with Dread.
I've been enjoying Dread. I think it's definitely a game that's... It's not... Look, it's not like Twilight Princess. A baby wouldn't be able to play it, I think. This is a game that's sort of... I don't know. For me, it felt a bit sort of like a mid... Starts you in the middle, I guess, in terms of difficulty. Like, I think some people expect when they start a Nintendo game that Nintendo is going to sort of ease them in, or it's going to be something where... What they used to do for a while was that thing where you play the whole game and it's really easy, and then there's bonus worlds and that's where they put all the difficult stuff. That's what they did with Mario 3D World and that sort of era of games. But I think this was one that, like, the tutorials are fine and everything if you're a gamer, but it is something that's like, if you're someone who hasn't played Metroid before because the last console Metroid was on the Wii, Other M, and you might not have played that one because you heard it was bad, which, look, everyone has different opinions on, but you might have not had a chance to play a console Metroid in 15 years or something. So a lot of people are coming to it for this. I think it's a good game. I don't know. Do you have any thoughts on, I guess, if someone's just, like, coming to this for the first time?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to know what you're getting yourself into when it comes to a Metroid game, because my first Metroid game was Fusion, and I had no idea. I'd never played a Metroidvania before, so, like, I did not know a thing about, like, okay, what do you mean I can't get through here? Did I forget something? And I just thought I'd just softlock myself somewhere in the game. I am very excited about Metroid Dread just because of all of the new Metroid fans that we're getting because of it. And I think it's a good one for somebody who has never played a Metroid game to go ahead and start with. I think that style is a good one to go with. You really have to have a lot of patience if you've never played one before, and know that it's, once you realize that a lot of it is just pattern recognition, you can, like, kind of fly through it a whole lot easier. But I think, I feel like it would be a good one for somebody to start with, as long as they know what they're getting themselves into, that it's not just a, okay, we're going to make it super easy at the beginning and then it'll gradually get better. It's like, no, it's going to be hard from the moment you start, and it's actually going to feel right. A little easier as you go on, because, like, I know when I first got chased by the Emmys, I was crying, and now, like, I just kind of yell a little bit, but not crying anymore.
That's a good recommendation. I'm not crying anymore. You can put that on the box.
I'm not crying anymore.
Because, yeah, look, it is a game where... I found the most difficult part to be about the first hour or two as well. I was like, we're so early on, but I've died about 5 times to an instant death horror monster that's chasing me.
Only 5 times? I mean, I've died like 500 times, and I'm okay with that.
Yeah, that was in the first hour. But look, you'll die a lot, but the checkpoints system isn't too bad. But I think Elias will be jealous if we're having a Metroid conversation without him. So I guess we should wrap up.
Well, Cody, this is it. I'm so glad I got to host with you again.
It's been a fun time. Hopefully I'll be able to see you in person at some point again in the near future.
I miss you so much. I hope so.
That's all completely out of our control, but I hope to at one point physically attend a ZU-thon, and everyone can watch the Cody Zone in person. It'll be very exciting.
Yeah. I'm giving you a giant hug because I miss you. I haven't seen you in 2 years, and that's just, I can't handle it.
So we will talk to you soon. Next up is the credits, and after that, the bloopers. Take it away, Eden.
It's over already? No! Well, yes, actually. You've finished this, the 19th episode of the ZU Cast, which, as the hosts mentioned, means it's now time for the credits. Taking up the hosting helm today were Cody Davies and Amanda Van Heil. It is due to their efforts that you may consider yourself hosted. Shona Johnson continued her guided tour down memory lane in the fifth part of her year-long Zelda History segment. Connor Schultz presented another piece of heart, namely the Zelda fan community and our very own ZU-thon charity event.
Join the Zelda Universe forums.
Finally, Randy Marr gave us another, rather timely idea for a possible twist on the Zelda formula. I'm Eden Biskin, the executive producer and Zelda Universe forums liaison. That's Biskin, not Biscuit or Bisquick. Cody Davies is our consulting producer and actual former reality show star. Seriously, look it up. Kelly Timmerman is our lead audio surgeon, better known as head editor. Andy Bundy is our surgical assistant editor. Mary Stowe is our social media liaison. Caden Garvey and Alexandria Gribble do the graphics for our YouTube releases. The ZU Cast is a production of the ZUBC, a division of Zelda Universe's media team. You'll find the ZU Cast on every major podcast directory, as well as YouTube. If you want to leave us feedback, your best bets for our seeing it are email at podcast@zeldauniverse.net or the
Zelda Universe forums
in Community Central's ZUcast hub thread. You can also interact with Zelda Universe on social media, at Zelda Universe on Twitter and Facebook, and at Zelda Universe TV on Instagram, YouTube, and Twitch. A new Age of Calamity DLC pack may be out by the time you hear this, and next month, the official Skyward Sword soundtrack finally releases in Japan a decade after the original game's release. You can bet your butt I'm getting it. So yeah, we'll have stuff to talk about for our 20th modern episode. Good thing too, because we've already started working on it. You'll hear us then. Happy spoopy season!
Hello, this is Elias Thompson. I'm here to regretfully inform you that this episode of the podcast does not have any bloopers whatsoever. That's it. That's all I have to say. Have a good rest of your day and play Metroid Dread.